You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's political commentary.
We are about ready to start now. I have on the line Associate Professor Jennifer Curtin. How are you this morning, Jennifer?
I'm good, thank you.
Political limbo, eh?
Yeah, it is really, but no, I don't think in a bad way.
You think they're taking their time and sorting out the best deal?
Yeah, well, I think realistically, even though we're saying it's already, I don't know, 18 or 19 days, and how terrible is that?
Oh, is it that long?
He did always say that he had to wait for the special votes, and we know that they made a difference, and they made it closer, right? So more complicated.
Absolutely.
And I think the other thing is, you know, we want a government that's going to last the 3 years. So if we take it from special votes, then that was Saturday and it's Thursday and he said he wants another 24 hours.
Right.
Or thereabouts. So that's six days.
Right.
You know.
When you think about the special votes, it's not that long at all.
No. So I know that people think, and you know, this is a really long time to wait for a government, but comparatively speaking with countries overseas, this isn't that long at all, actually. And, you know, Europe's been doing proportional representation governments for close to 100 years, and this happens, to them quite often. And that's people don't freak out. The euro doesn't fall through the floor. So I do wonder if we're kind of like chasing our tails on this just because partly the mainstream media don't have anything else to fill up their political columns with.
Very good point. Other than, I don't know, Matthew Hooton quitting Twitter or...
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are some things going on in the world that we might like to know about
exactly.
Instead of what Winston Peters ate for breakfast or something.
It's very true. You just get these fantastic opportunities, though, where somebody swans out onto the pavement or into a hallway. Minister, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose because it's secret and it has to be that way and... That there is that lot of speculation, and it's obviously because it's Winston as well, right?
Yeah.
Because
he's done this before, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, one thing I think is interesting about the 17 days is Australia actually had to go through this process when Julia Gillard and Tony Abbott came within cooey of each other and had to negotiate with like three or four independents, and they took 17 days. But part of it is, you know, they have to go backwards and forwards between the two, the middle party. And in our case, it just happens to be this guy with a really big personality who really likes a soundbite and is good at creating, you know, a lot of speculation.
Yeah. So that is just what we're waiting for then. Just for listeners and for my sake. Am I correct in understanding that it's kind of two big meetings a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, with both of the major parties, and Winston's kind of laying out what he would like in an ideal world, and they're saying yes to that, maybe no to that?
Yeah, I think what we have to remember is, you know, like if you look at, which I did last week, at Winston, you know, the New Zealand First list of policies, they have a policy platform on, probably 20 items. Now, you know, New Zealand First would have had to prioritise those because they can't necessarily negotiate them all. And then it's not necessarily a yes or a no. It might be on, say, housing affordability. It might be something like, well, we could provide these work on these three areas, but not on these three areas. And so there might be five or six key areas that he's going to want to see what each side is moving on. And so you could imagine that couldn't be done in just one meeting.
Totally.
I mean, in 2005, it was a little bit clearer, I think, even though it was a close election. Clark was able to really just sort of nail it, partly with offering him foreign affairs.
Mm-hmm.
She herself was a foreign affairs, you know, policy wonk, so she knew that she could sort of sit alongside him, and she kept trade for Gough, and so it was quite a nice split and very functional and organised, and you know, whereas this time round it is a bit more complex. And I suppose what we have to remember is, even though we talk about Winston, He has a party that he is, you know, a delegate of in a way. So he's going to have to also speak with them later today about right. where all this is at. And he's already saying he wants, you know, his party to have 75% support for minimum of the sort of what's on the table in terms of making that decision, because he's going to want his party to stay unified through the next 3 years.
Should we bother speculating on his intentions? Has he made kind of his top three things to table clear at all, or should we just let him get on with it?
Personally, I think we should let him get on with it. I mean, there has been a lot of speculation, so you'll read one outlet.
Yeah.
They'll talk about three key economic issues and how the dollar's plummeting and it's all Winston's fault. And then you'll read another lot who'll be talking about the sort of more social infrastructure type issues as the three key. So out of this, we could speculate that there are probably six key issues, and it depends what the journalists are deciding to emphasise on the day to get... I mean, I suppose I'm a bit of a cynic in all of this, and that I do think that there is almost too much speculation this time round that isn't particularly healthy from a voter's perspective, because basically we know that close to 8% of people voted for this party, and they were really transparent on the policies that they have.
Right.
Those are the policies they're going to be negotiating. We don't know yet what they are trading off in order to support who. Yes, the media will guess, but ultimately, you know, there are decisions that get made based on, I would say, whether New Zealand First wants a legacy, like in this, not in the policy, just the policy sense, but in also retaining their status as a political party. Because what we know for minor parties going into political office or into government is that they're always the losers. The majors don't lose. What we see is opinion polls start to plummet because they never get credited with the wins.
Right.
They always get credited with the losses and the, you know, tail wagging the dog
right.
mantra. So they, you know, there's a real risk for New Zealand First that in the next election they might get 3% or 4% of the vote, and we've seen this with New Zealand First before. Yeah, it's really, really hard. And so they'll understand that because they've been here twice before,
yeah.
that they need to ensure that what they negotiate in a policy sense is also going to keep support from their voters. So that they live another, you know, electoral cycle beyond this one.
Speaking of keeping support from your voters and trade-offs, a lot was made, I think around about the time, just before the special votes came in, National, or Paula Bennett saying to the Greens, hey guys, let's talk. A lot in the press, Houghton again in particular, saying, why won't you? That's a great idea. But surely the Green Party members would make a vote of no confidence in James Shaw, and that's not really possible. Or is it?
Well, I think actually this was calculated on the right, you know, a move, you know, because David Farrell was arguing for it as well, and actually we've even had talk of grand coalitions. I mean, I think the reality of the Green vote dropping from what it was last time to this time is partly a result of those Green voters that might have been a little bit National inclined, and that when Matiria Turia decided,
right.
When that issue arose, then the Greens, yes, they've lost some of their vote to Labour, but I don't think, you know, if you look at the math, you know, Labour didn't win far more. They won far more than just what the Greens lost, right?
Right.
So my thinking is that the 6.5% to 7% that the Greens still hold are core Green voters. They're Green through and through. They're not sort of a little bit light blue green. They're really kind of activist Green and believe passionately in Green core values. So if the Greens negotiated with National and went into government with them, it would be, I think, a disaster for the Greens.
Right.
But based on what we know about those who vote for Green. So I think it was always just a little bit of a furphy, and partly to fill the dead air, but
right.
also partly to, you know, test the waters and maybe go, because I think that National would quite like to see the end of the Greens. And, you know, I've heard some National supporters say that. And so it would, you know, like, the more they can decimate the left, the better it is for them. It's electoral politics, right?
So in terms of it being a calculated move and not really something serious, do you think it was more to make the Greens look unreasonable or potentially to scare Winston?
Yeah, a bit of both, I think. Definitely to kind of say to Winston, well, you know...
You're not our only hope.
Yeah, but I mean, I think Winston's pretty smart and would know... And he knows enough about the National Party, right, because that's his original home. So he still knows a lot of these players that are working behind the scenes and stuff. So I would say that, it was partly that, but it was also, you know, perhaps, you know, I mean, National do have to do more work in the environment, climate change space. They know that. And there are blue-green members inside their party who might aspire to seeing... A relationship that's stronger than already exists between the Nats and the Greens, but I don't think they're the ones in charge.
Right. All right, Jennifer, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Have a good week.
Maybe next time we speak to you, we'll have a government to talk
about.
Yeah,
possibly.
Okay, cheers.
Cheers.
You just heard a bit of political commentary. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.